But because in a rather common usage, we dropped the word bioethics as a kind of a general and generic designation of a bunch of topics that may be of some interest, and we'll get started with some of them today anyway. If we don't get past one or two, that's all right. And if we want to go past them because you're not particularly interested in the topic or in the specific topic, let's move on. But the term bioethics is kicked around a good deal today, and I don't like the term. And I don't quite know why, but it refers to a lot of those problems, and most often it is used to refer to those dilemmas in which we find ourselves in the face of new technology that is making it possible for us to do things with the human body particularly and most specifically that create in us some dis-ease, some discomfiture in the face of the ambiguities that develop. Now, I'm going to start with a specific one, and let's kick it around for a while. And it isn't unlike the texts that have been used in the last two evenings in connection with the Good Samaritan. The problem is probably easy to describe. That's not where the problem is. It isn't hard to understand the significance of, for instance, the Good Samaritan story. The hard part is in doing it, doing whatever you're supposed to do after you've done it, after you understood it. I suppose a half a dozen times in this last year, I've been called up to one of the floors in our hospital by one or another doctor and asked to look at a baby. They do this because they know that before I'm going to talk about a baby, I want to see the baby. Or before I'm going to talk about a situation, I want to see it. Because I work clinically more than theoretically and academically. And I don't like to talk about a person or be a participant in any kind of a decision regarding a person and his destiny, whether it's an infant or an old person, without first having looked at the person. It's easy to make decisions in the abstract and removed. But if you've seen a little baby, like the one I'm going to describe, it's quite a different thing to make the decision. Now, the baby that I is half a dozen times this year that I've looked at has been what the doctors would technically call a child born with Down syndrome. Down syndrome is what is more popularly referred to as Mongolism. And you know that the distinctive facial characteristics of a Mongoloid child. Eyes look a little oriental. It's a genetic problem. It happens to occur somewhat more frequently in the later parts of childbearing age for a woman, a little bit more probability or possibility of this rather tragic situation. Now, associated with it is almost always some degree of retardation, mental retardation. It may be severe, and it may be rather slight. They may be fairly capable. They're lovely kids. When they, and particularly if the degree of retardation is not severe, so that they can communicate rather well and react to relationships and to environment and get excited. I say excited, you're going to hear me say that word a good deal this month, I suppose, because I guess I regard it as one of the most essential factors in being human. To be capable of excitement. Now, very often with these children, there are multiple genetic deficits. not only the facial features and the mental retardation, but very often there will be other genetically based problems, like no connection between the stomach and the small intestine. Now, obviously, the baby cannot be fed. If you fed the baby, there would be nothing but excruciating pain and death. And you can't do that. Now, I don't know for how many centuries such babies have been fed, you know, not knowing what was wrong with the plumbing. And the baby simply goes into a screaming demise. Today we have advanced technology, and it's not very hard to solve a problem like the one I just described. Surgeon makes a relatively small incision in this little tummy and goes in there, and with the skill of the plastic surgeon, puts together some parts that weren't joined the way God usually intends them to be. Makes an opening in the stomach, attaches, sews up the opened end of the small intestine, then the end that he's had open. And after that has healed a little bit, then it's possible to give the baby some nourishment by mouth. In a rather considerable number, of these situations, later on they'll discover that there are some other genetic problems. Batting average is not awfully good if they have more than the simple, straightforward Down syndrome symptoms. That is, the facial thing and the somewhat retarded mentality, more or less retarded mentality. Now, when I get called up on these things, it's simply because we have a multidisciplinary approach to such problems in the hospital. And we usually assemble a group of people who can look at it from different aspects and from different areas of concern, and perhaps bring some individual specific personal concerns to the problem and to the mix in the decision, and also some professional insights that might come from people like social workers, pastors, of course the surgeon, the pediatrician, the nurse, the parent. This is usually the team that's assembled. Now, we've just come through this big, we haven't come through it, we're just starting, I think, the big fuss about abortion. We're going to have fuss about this kind of thing as the knowledge of the way in which these problems are dealt with becomes more and more known to the general public. One way of handling this sort of thing is to say, with the probabilities of mental retardation and 1, 2, 3, 4 more genetically based problems, it would be better to let this baby die before the technology had arrived at the place where this could be rather easily done, let's say the joining of the interrupted plumbing. Almost all hospitals had some place where little babies were put that could not live, and over a period of days or sometimes weeks, the baby dehydrated and died. Nobody likes these problems. It's a terrible thing. It is so bad in many ways and so emotionally distressing to stand by helplessly and to say there's nothing that we know how to do, we let the baby die. And then to have some nurse or a few nurses go walking into the little room once in a while to see how the baby's doing, hoping that it doesn't do well at all, and it doesn't do well fast. I have always had a great deal of respect for doctors and nurses caught up in this kind of situation. Dreadful thing. But now comes along increased surgical technology, improved developments that are fantastic. So the surgeon called in on a situation like this says, after examining the baby with the new modern technology that can take a good look inside, other than see exactly what's wrong, "Oh, I can fix this up very easily," says the surgeon. "If the parents will please sign a consent form, I'll go ahead with the surgery." The doctor, the pediatrician, may say, "Well, now, just a minute. Before we decide to go ahead and even ask the parents for the consent form and signature, are we agreed that we should in any way recommend this to the parents? Or do we simply want to explain the situation or want to make a choice?" Now, what the parents choose involves the rest of the team that's involved in this one now. Because the doctor and the nurse may have to do things that are contrary to their own convictions regarding the situation, if you leave it to the parents' decision. If the parents and the doctors agree, and let's say the decision is to do nothing, then the nurse may step forward and say, "All right, are you now assigning me to the task of presiding over this child's slow death?" If the decision is made by the doctors and some of the rest that this baby should not live because the chances are that it could not survive in anything like a realization of its humanity, parents may object and say, "Nothing doing. You know, there's always a chance of some kind of a miracle." Or the parents may say, and this is a much more common one for us at this time, the parents may say, "We will not sign the consent form. We want this baby to die." Now, I'm putting in that one roughly, I guess, more roughly than what their action is saying. But if you argue with the parents about this, and this has come up many times, I'm sure it's 4 or 5 times in the last year for me, the case that I've been involved in, parents have said, "No, we do not think that it is wise to let this baby live. First place, you put this tiny little baby through excruciating a surgery that may involve excruciating agony in one way or another. It's hard enough to get a baby's plumbing started. There's a lot of mothers know with colic and all this stuff. Anyway, and now with all of this sort of thing, to start out life with a surgical wound involving the gastrointestinal tract makes it harder yet. There's a good deal of suffering for the little child." But the parents may say, "If this child is severely handicapped now, we may have to keep this child in an institution. Are you guys going to pay the bill? Will you see to it my kids get through college while we divert all of our money into this almost bankrupting situation?" And believe me, it can bankrupt. Typical cost is $25,000 a year in the better places that are not simply warehouses. I couldn't afford it. I could for a couple of years. By that time, the equity I have in my house would be gone, and I would be out of business on it. All right, what do you do? The road gets awfully narrow that you're passing by and finding this little baby along the side, or this family along the side. It's a problem. It's a moral problem. And it has to be dealt with ethically. And there are very few guidelines. The only thing that we've discovered is that there is, in most of these situations, nothing right that can be done. have the choice only of bad and not quite so bad, or bad and quite a bit better. We're dealing constantly with ambiguity. And even in the sense that you don't know what the future is, you may decide that you do this because you think that the genetic deficits are minimal, only to find that the child cannot in any way, at any time in the future, relate. This happens. I suppose it also happens that some of the babies that are allowed to die may also have been those who could have turned out such a way that they could relate. Always we hear somebody raise a voice, say, what are you trying to do, play God? And I used to squirm terribly at that, because I suppose I felt that we were dangerously close to that. Today I take a little different attitude and say, yes, that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to play God, if you want to use the crass term, for being God's regents upon this earth. If we didn't want to play God and take a responsibility for such concerns and make decisions, life and death decisions, if we didn't want to do that, of course, we would have simply taken this baby out of the delivery room. No, maybe we wouldn't have brought the baby in the delivery room at all, or the mother in. As soon as you start, then you're kind of trapped. And I think a great deal of what it means to be human is to accept our regency. That's what we're here for. We're princesses and princes. And the Father King has said, take care of it for me. And take care of each other for me. And we act on his behalf. And I think this is playing God. And to be truly human, that's exactly what we have to do. To modify what happens on this earth. Well, what do you do? How do you find principles, criteria that guide you? Can you commit a nurse to the responsibility for of watching a baby die under such circumstances? Can you blame the doctor who says, I have finely honed skills that make it possible for me to go in there and in only a few minutes do that which is necessary to keep this baby alive in the physical sense? Heart beating, respiration functioning, circulation taking place. And the baby may live for 50 years, but may not have any capability of relating to another human being. Now, along with this problem, and the reason you're going to hear a great deal more about it, is that some types of problems that are related to this thing that I've been suggesting are hereditary. And we have learned how to manage so many symptoms. Take diabetes now, for example. I'm sure there's some diabetics in the room. It would be strange if there weren't in a group this large. Now, in 1918, would have been very few diabetics sitting in this room if we had had this room and this crowd together. The reason was that most of the diabetics were dead by that time. Then came along a relatively simple and now taken for granted drug, insulin. Came to the United States in 1918, as I recall. Now, since that time, diabetics have lived out essentially normal lives. But there's been an explosion of diabetes in our population because we can control the symptoms of it rather largely. While there are some problems that diabetics may experience, usually a little later in life, for the most part, they are symptom-free. Now, there is a great increase in the number of diabetics. Now, it is going to be possible, they think, theoretically it's possible today, through a skill in a procedure called amniocentesis, to determine ahead of time whether the child has Down syndrome or not. By putting a needle into the amniotic fluid in the womb, tapping it off, examining the cells and the molecules, study of, in the new advanced studies, chromosomal studies, determining that the baby has Down syndrome problem, and then now theoretically possible and perhaps soon to be practically possible to introduce a corrective cell. You talk about playing God. Now you're playing God with a microscope, you know, and this microscopic surgery on chromosomes. Well, now, if it's possible now to correct that, the strange part that my geneticist friends tell me about this is that while when you do that, you correct it for the individual, but you do not correct the hereditary factor in the gene. At least they don't know how to do that yet. So we may have an explosion of Down syndrome 20 years from now, or 40 years from now, or 60 years from now, because of the way this stuff multiplies up. Bentley Glass, one of the world's leading geneticists, says that there are 10 things, Down syndrome being among them, which he thinks by about the year 2100 will be routinely dealt with, so that the symptoms of otherwise devastating things will be controlled. But he says it'll take everybody about 2 hours every day to do the correctional things that will make it possible for them to live through that day, you know. And he says, for instance, these aren't one of the 10, but he said, it takes a little while to polish your eyeglasses every morning, and there's a hereditary factor in, you know, a number of people that wear eyeglasses. You have to put in your dentures, probably, but also some hereditary factors in this. He said, these are just examples now. But then you take a shot of insulin, and then you take a shot in the other arm for something else to control symptoms of one of these other things. And then he wonders if we can afford it, and how we're going to deal with it. But I'm just taking now the one that is immediate. We are dealing with it at Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge. Are we going to allow amniocentesis to be done, and under what circumstances? Well, we're doing it. We're doing it when we have a 40-year-old mother who's going to have a child, and she comes in early enough. She may be informed that there is a risk of Down syndrome, and she may have offered to her an examination through amniocentesis to determine. Now, if it is determined that the child does indeed have Down syndrome, then what do you do? Do you then say, we recommend abortion? Now, if you don't, what's the difference? You know, you could have waited. Does it do him any good? Does it do any good to know that much ahead of time, and to be worrying and fretting about what's the degree of handicap? This is not a medical problem. The medical problems have been solved. They know how to do it. It's your problem. It's a problem of society. Just like abortion is not a medical problem. That's a rather simple procedure. They know how to do it. It's society's problem. I happen to be one of those who takes the position that abortion should be allowed under certain circumstances. I came to it after years of agonizing study because I was a little bit too close to the topic to deal with it simply theoretically. I had to sit with people facing it. I don't know what I would say if somebody came and said, should we do routine amniocentesis and demand abortion on genetically deficient people? Now, these are not theoretical problems. They're very practical, down-to-earth, gutsy kinds of stuff that some people in our society have to deal with. But when they have dealt with them, they are up against society's attitudes that may point strongly accusing fingers and not be quite ready to surround in the agony of the decision or in the agony of the post-decision guilt. I don't know of any way to deal with the kind of situation, that baby that I was describing. That's not an unusual occurrence. Let me repeat that. I don't know of any way of dealing it without being guilty. It's another way of saying that there's, you know, not a good or a bad or a right or a wrong, a black or a white. Well, what do you say? Used to be that you could pass by on the other side of the road and not know that this was lying over there in the brush right alongside. It was hidden from you. You were protected. You are no longer protected from it. There was a two-hour TV show on exactly this kind of situation. Snyder, remember him? You know, the guy on the Tomorrow Show, isn't it? I don't like him. But he did an excellent show on passive euthanasia. And that's what we're talking about now. Are you going to do passive euthanasia or not on this child? Are you going to allow the child to die by not, and cause death by doing nothing? And what is the difference between passive euthanasia and active euthanasia as a moral issue? Whether we like it or not, we are rapidly approaching the day that we're going to have to seriously consider and take a position on active euthanasia. The technologies that have been developed are forcing that issue. The road narrows down, and we're going to have to be confronted with it. When the road was very wide, it was possible to go on ignoring the things that were on the other side because we didn't even know they were there. Only a few people knew. And we're left in that lonely, lonely, lonely position of having to do things that, without knowing whether it was right or not, and wondering what would happen if people found out. I came into the hospital one night years and years ago because one of our pastoral care residents was ill, and he had called and asked if I would mind standing in for him for the night. And I got there about 11 o'clock or so, and about 11:15, 11:30, a doctor came, very fine, fine doctor. And he said, have you got any coffee around here, Padre? And I said, yeah, we've got coffee. And he said, well, do you mind if I sip? I'm tired. And we started to drink some coffee. And he says, hey, let me give you a hypothetical situation. And he proceeded to tell me about a patient up on the sixth floor. Now, he didn't say the patient was on the sixth floor and didn't give a name. It was strictly hypothetical, but he described the patient that I'd just been up to see a couple hours before. I knew the patient was approaching death. We wired up to everything that we have. And, man, we got a lot of things to plug into human beings to keep hearts going and respiration going. And he gave me the hypothetical situation that was as real as could be and still breathing up there. And then said, in a situation like that, what would you as a pastor do? So I told him I didn't know what I'd do as a pastor if I were the doctor. But I proceeded to tell him that to be human means that we make choices and decisions. and to realize that we're free to make them. But along with them come the responsibility for making them. It's the uncomfortable thing about being human. The one thing we don't have any right to do is ignore it and to cop out. So in effect, I was telling him, there's a right and wrong here. The right is to do something. Either go up and pull the plug, or go up there and put in a couple more plugs, a couple more gadgets if you think it will help. You have a right to do it, to make either one of those decisions. But decide you have to. And join in the agony and perhaps join in the meanings of the cross. And join in the agony and perhaps join in the meanings of the cross by stepping into the dilemmas and the agonies of human beings. I keep wondering what the church, what the congregation can do to help us. Society has to be better prepared for the implications of this knowledge, this information, than what we were on abortion, which is largely an emotional issue with us still. Okay, what do you do? What's right, what's wrong? I scared you by saying that whatever you do is right, or that you have whatever you do is more right than doing nothing. Maybe that answered or told you that I, but it isn't quite as uncomplicated as that, I guess. If it was your baby, what would you want? If it was your baby, would you feel that it was permissible to either ask for the operation that would mean that the child would survive, or to ask that it not be done? If this were your hospital, as it is, of course, it's Lutheran General Hospital, it's owned by our church. Are we right in doing these things or not?
Well, don't you think that one of the really very serious aspects of the problem is that parents are confronted with this monumental difficulty once in their lives, with no background, with no experience, with no knowledge, and then to have them have to face this question? What I'm thinking of is this, that doctors and people like yourself have been in contact with this scores of times, hundreds of times, and you've thought a great deal about it, you've prayed a great deal about it, you've made decisions on the basis of what you said, that sometimes to be human you have to do certain things. But here you have this monumental problem before a young couple who had been dreaming of having their first baby, and here it is, only once. Well, when you compare this, for example, with any other number of difficult things that we have to decide, it may, we say, well, we do this very often, but many of the difficult things we have to decide are not difficulties of life and death.
No.
They're difficult, but not. So I would appreciate your commenting upon what the general attitude seems to be of inexperienced people who are confronted by this problem.
Well, I'm not sure that I can answer that one out of my experience without distorting it, but let me try it. The reason is that I said that there have probably been 6 cases very similar to what I was just describing in the last year or so at our hospital. Now that, you have to see, this isn't doesn't represent a high incidence of this sort of thing. We have 3,800 births in our hospital a year. It's a very large number. And because we are the kind of hospital we are, we get a lot of high-risk situations brought to us, because the obstetricians would rather have them delivered where there are the facilities, for instance, high-risk nursery, and high-risk OB. So we probably get a disproportionate number. But out of the 6, I know 3 of them, four of them, involved families, the mother, which was a nurse. And in all 4 cases, the nurse mother said, let this baby go. The 2 that where the parents said, do the operation, this child must live, were the inexperienced. Now, nursing may bring a distortion to the situation. This may not necessarily mean that they were better qualified to understand what the situation was. Even. I don't know about that. We've talked about it many, many hours. What does this mean that the nurse mothers, professional nurse mother, in 4 out of 6 situations said, let the baby go, and the 2 others? So your question, I think, is right on, Bob. My own feeling, and maybe it's because I share the loneliness my doctor friends and nurse friends experience in this kind of situation, and parent friends that are involved, and wish that there were more that could surround the decision in some way or another. It's a tough thing to go home from a hospital and meet your neighbors and your relatives, for instance, having made one decision one way or the other, and be afraid to tell people what decision you made, in particular if you made the decision to let the baby go, for fear that they would now regard you as some kind of monster who could do this to a little baby. Well, if there was a fellowship that could receive, if society was more ready to receive, with some kind of understanding of the enormity of the problem, then it might be better. So I think I kind of welcome the day that we're being forced to talk about it more openly. But the congregation is the most underutilized resource in this world, I suppose. We don't do much with them, you know. We just do them to them.
Related to this is another very significant aspect of it, and that is that man was created by God with an absolutely unquenchable desire to know and to learn and to keep on going. And so We're searching, searching always. Now, the other day I read, as I'm sure you did, and you've heard of it before, that these two young researchers at MIT have discovered a means of artificially making a gene. In other words, they have synthesized now the process of making life itself. What's going to happen in consequence of this? And I noticed that one of the Harvard professors immediately spoke up and almost said, I wish it had never been done.
Well, the community stopped the research.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
So here you have it. And these two come in conflict, you see, right in
yes.
the very situation that you mentioned. The same thing, for example, just to illustrate again quickly, what is it that makes us want to put cameras on Mars and do these incredible things that they are doing? It's this unquenchable desire to know, and we didn't create that.
Which is very much a part of being human.
Yeah, it's part of being
yeah.
human.
Sure.
And so you get to the point, you see, where you can create the very problems that you're trying to eliminate or conceivably solve the problems that you are trying to eliminate. You're up against the conflict.
The high-risk nursery in any good hospital is a good example of this, because they are pulling kids through that could never have lived otherwise, never have lived. But it's way too early to know what the score is on these things, say 10, 20 years later. Most likely, they are, the overwhelming majority are going to be essentially normal human beings.
What about the guilt factor on the part of the parents afterwards? How can that be dealt with?
Yeah, this is what I was sort of suggesting, maybe a role of a congregation, a healing, forgiving fellowship. It'd be great stuff if the chaplain in the hospital, let's say, who may be involved or know about the situation, draw the pastor into the situation, and that the pastor would have the resource of a congregation that was informed and concerned and able to create that healing, forgiving fellowship, which I don't think many congregations are.
Mm-hmm. Is it good or bad that the news media take hold of these things, such as the case of the girl out in New Jersey,
Quinlan,
and give it national or international notice and attention? Is this good or bad?
I think, let me get at it backwards, Dr. Morfitt. I think if this had happened at Lutheran General Hospital, she would have been pulled off the respirator after about one month at the latest. And there would never have been this national attention to the situation. She may have lived as she is now living. She may have died right then. The reason I say this, and I just soon, you know, don't go running around to some newspaper and quote it now, or to the Lutheran Standard or something. We're here as a bunch of people to share some agonies, among other things, along with our joys. But that was a peculiar situation and a very unfortunate one. And maybe the most unfortunate of all was that she lived. You know, she's still alive in this coma. Poor parents going through this perpetual agony, and it caused an awful lot of people to say, you see what happens, you know, she could live without it. What if they'd pulled her off of it earlier, whatever. Besides the fact that she may have been involved in a drug overdose or whatever this thing was in the first place, it's a distorted kind of a situation. But these are not unusual situations at all, in which you pull the plug. We did it to one of our nurses who stuck her head through a windshield in an automobile accident. Brain tissue oozing out one ear. No way that she could have survived with anything like a capability to relate in this world. And while we fussed around trying to decide, because we were emotionally involved, it was one of our family, it was one of our gals. Student nurse. Her father came in from overseas and took a look at her and said, "What's the problem?" Now, this is a father who is in deep and intense grief, but comes to us and says, "What's the problem? You've explained, and I've read what you've written to me and told me." "Well, the problem is, should we leave her on the respirator and keep feeding her? If we stop those things, she will surely die." And he said, "You stop now." And we stopped. And it was a right decision. I have no question about the decision at all. Now, see, that's the same kind of a thing. We may have kept that gal going for the next 3 months.
But I've thought of it in terms of the fact that these poor parents are tried before a nation of 225 million people.
Ridiculous.
Who are all judging one way or the other without the facts, without an understanding of the situation. And hence, the newspapers, the media obviously have a very significant role to play in doing some thinking about these things. The simplistic answer to say that the public has a right to know everything, this doesn't make sense to me.
Well, the public has a right to know. I have no question with that one. The question is, are you giving them knowledge? Mm-hmm. Now, what does knowledge mean? You're there just a minute. Let me just finish one part here. We have something, we're very much concerned now in hospitals with consent forms, one kind or another. The patient has a right to know. If the patient is incapable of receiving the communication, then responsible relatives have a right to know. Now, what does it mean to know? The doctor says you have choriocarcinoma, which is, how many people know what choriocarcinoma is?
Okay.
There's one person in the room that does. My daughter died of choriocarcinoma. It's a very great reality to a couple of us sitting here. But if the doctor says you have choriocarcinoma, what in the world does it mean? If they say to you, your daughter has choriocarcinoma, what does it mean? Nothing. Now, he may have said, I just gave them the knowledge that this was choriocarcinoma. Now, there's a thousand things to know about choriocarcinoma. One was that, what year is it in the years of our Lord? And if it happens to be in the late 60s, everybody dies. If it's in the 70s, nobody dies from that one. Now, that's something to know. Something has to be known about the batting averages and the chances. Something has to be known about the progress of the disease, that there are signs to watch for. And when the process invades the brain, you're out of business. And death is soon and certain. If it doesn't invade the brain, there's always a chance of recovery. Cancer is a word, and it means scare to most people, huh? Yet most people recover from cancers. There are more recoverable cancers than there are killing cancers left in this world. Yet not many people understand that or know it at all. To be deeply informed, profoundly informed about the situation so that you can make a decision is a requirement. But of course the papers don't do that in the Quinlan case, as you point out. It didn't do it even very well in that Snyder show that I referred to. Although I think on balance it was a good thing that one came out. It just came out at the wrong time of the day. It starts at 12 o'clock, and how many people are going to sit up from 12 to 2 to watch? But the nature of the information, informed consent is the legal term that we are always dealing with. What is information? Before you give the consent. excuse me for taking that much long before getting back.
You were probably saying something of what I was thinking. This Quinlan thing was so exploited in that, but some people are thinking about this and facing this, and in some way maybe partially prepared if they ever have to make this decision themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very small way, and it really put this family on the
terrible
situation. But I was thinking, we have a retarded child, and he's not extremely serious. He is able to respond. Mm-hmm. But when I was in college, I wrote a paper on whether or not to institutionalize a retarded child. At that time, I had no idea that I was going to have one.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it prepared me for some of the things that I've had to examine myself on, and, you know.
Yes, I'm sure.
So I'm very thankful that I wrote a paper on it, too.
Yes.
And just little things, that anything that we can do to help people to face these things. And like you say, the nurse mothers were the ones who said, let your baby die. They've seen the suffering more.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing I didn't know about, the drain on the family and all of these things that you just don't know about.
But also, and you've seen, I'm sure, through the association with other parents and families that have retarded children, you've seen some where it works out beautifully, and they're very sweet and very lovely and rather problem-free situations. Mm-hmm. It goes all the way from that to the extreme where it just immobilizes the family for anything else, but the attention to the one child. Well, we're not talking, obviously, about things that don't relate to us, and they will relate a whole lot more in the future.
Aren't more and more older people or people younger than we are saying that are leaving a written statement of the fact to their children.
Living wills.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think that's helpful, isn't it, for the family if they've made a statement or...
They're not legally binding, and legally they're of no significance whatsoever. I'm working with a commission nationally right now on what can be done to change some of that sort of thing. And I'm not in favor. I'm in favor of living wills. Do you all know what we're talking about? Where you write and say something like, I want you people to understand, my wife and my kids and, you know, I want you all to understand that if I get into a situation where life cannot have any meaning and that I'm approaching termination of life, don't do the extraordinary things to keep me alive. Today, you understand, it's theoretically possible to keep any one of you alive for the next 1,000 years. I think Alexis Carroll's chicken heart is still beating in some laboratory someplace, isn't it? You know, that's, what, 40 years, 50 years? That thing, just in a saline solution, is keeping popping away. Well, you can better not do that to me. Well, you wire them up to everything we've got, heart-lung machines, you know, and all, dialysis to purify the blood and take over the kidney thing, and a respirator to breathe for us, and are we human or aren't we? Well, you can make out a will, a statement that says, don't do it, or I'll come back and haunt you, or something. It has no legal force whatsoever. But I am much in favor. I've flip-flopped on this. First I was in favor of them, and then when I was assured that they had no legal binding force at all, then I went the other direction on the thing. Said, forget it. Now I'm back to thinking that it's a good thing, only because it gives you a chance to talk about it in your family. Now, I'm not going to tell my family that you cannot keep me alive, or you must keep me alive, because I don't know what in the world the situation is going to be. If I go bumping my head walking up to Heart Lake tomorrow or something and get a bad concussion and I'm in a coma for 3 weeks, I hope to goodness Gertrude doesn't say, hey, wait a minute, this guy said, you know, and they do nothing to keep me alive, you know. I would like that one, I'd like to live through that one. But I could also see circumstances like my sister and brother-in-law coming up tomorrow or day after, and Grandma, my brother-in-law's mother, has been in a coma for how long, Gertrude? 3 months?
4 months, 5 months.
Something like that. No? Just lying there. Now she can swallow it. Or no, she can't swallow. They put a tube down her mouth and into the stomach and feed her that way. Now, month after month, you know, this has been going on. Now, nobody's considering euthanasia, but nobody's doing anything extraordinary to keep her alive either, which I think is wise. And hopefully and apparently, as far as anybody can tell, there's no suffering. It just goes on. The main problem is, I suppose, emotional. The family stands by in this tension waiting. And then the other thing is the financial situation, which can be absolutely devastating. Because you can run out of insurance, bankrupt. We have procedures, we have situations in our hospital where it can cost you $1,000 a day to keep alive. $1,000 a day. Now, I hope my family understands that I ain't going to be worth it. I haven't worked all my life, you know, to, among other things, build up some kind of security for my family, have it all wiped out in $1,000 a day for 3 months, or whatever. You know,
what actually happens when they start procedures of that kind and the money runs out?
Oh. You just keep,
then is a decision
you
made.
You just keep going. But the time when perhaps it should have been stopped. And again, it's hard to talk about this one because you have to almost reduce it to a specific case to talk in any sense at all. There are times when it would pay to spend $1,000 a day to keep a human being going. It's what have you got left when it's over? And what's the family got left when it's over? But it's awfully hard to deal with that kind of a question. What we do always is continue the therapy, if it isn't one of these absolutely hopeless situations anyway, to continue the therapy. And sometimes the bills just go sky high and the other patients have to pay for it.
There's one other aspect to this that I think is familiar to you that has always said something to me. You remember George White's poem very
yes,
well.
Yes, yes.
They had two daughters, one very beautiful, normal in every other way, the other one a mongoloid. Cynthia, the latter, lived for 14 years. During most of those years, I was in close association with the family because I was on the same faculty and we were very close together. When Cynthia died, I talked with my friend George about it and in some way expressed the view that really it had been too bad that they had Cynthia. Because that's the way I felt, and almost to my amazement, you know what he replied? Bob, he said, we wouldn't have had it otherwise. We have learned more from this experience than we could have learned in any other way about certain problems of life.
I'm sure that this is the experience of a large number of people with seriously handicapped children. If the handicap, however, is of certain types and certain degrees, it goes beyond the place where, by on balance, you learn as much as it costs.
I don't want to suggest.
But you're dealing now with something that, and I'm glad you bring this one up. Those of you who didn't know Dr. Spohn, couldn't have known him, wouldn't realize that you're dealing here again with very capable people who have resources to bring to a situation that makes a world of difference. Another family may have had nothing but a bad experience out of the same kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. Because Dr. Spohn was an unusual person. You have better reason to know than I. Well, we'll be talking some more about problems that fit into this general category of agonizing, distressful, perplexing, ambiguous problems that confront us increasingly, and where modern technology is creating them almost by the day, Just very recently, a new gadget was developed. It's called an aortic balloon pump. It's inserted down into the aorta and pumps away, keeps the heart going that way. Well, this is the importance of the living will. You know, if you sit around some evening and say, hey, why don't we consider a living will in our family? The will isn't going to mean that much as far as legally binding decision is concerned, but your family has had a gimmick by which it is confronted with and with attitudes. Sue didn't have a living will, but she told us, hey, when the treatment, if we come to the place where the treatment is doing no good, do not keep me in the treatment, but bring me home so I can live until I die. Well, it was a contract we had with her because it had been talked over ahead of time. If we hadn't talked this over ahead of time, we may not have pulled her out of therapy or allowed her to pull herself out of therapy. But she made a wise decision, wiser than her parents could make at the moment, wiser than the doctors could make at the moment. It isn't an easy thing for a doctor to let a patient go. No, it's all against everything that's in them as far as training is concerned. Well, Sue came home. There came a time we had the close-up immediate decision to make. Do we take her over to the hospital, cut down into that body again to find some vein, some place where you can stick something in, a needle in, that'll allow us to feed her? Or do you say, hey, now is the time to celebrate her death? And with kind of a feeling of doxology, we let her go. Now, she prepared us for it by saying, you know, some interesting things. She told us once, don't go protesting my death until you go home and get reconciled to your own deaths. Then you can be of some use to me. And this is the kind of thing I think is really the bottom line of what we're talking about. Let's get reconciled to our own deaths. Then we can live. Not until we're reconciled to death can we live. And nor can we be helpful to other people until we have these two great experiences, living and dying, brought into some kind of understanding and tension and balance and whatever. Well, we'll take something maybe not quite as distressing next time. Okay.